The Art Dealer Diaries are brought to you by Medicine Man Gallery, specializing in antique Native American art, early Western art, including the famed Maynard Dixon, as well as modern art. You can find everything online at medicinemangallery.com. There's over 6,000 objects to select from. Also, the Charles Bloom Murder Mystery Series, written by yours truly, me, Mark Sublett. These can be found on Audible, eBooks, Amazon, and of course, the gallery at medicinemangallery.com. Really interesting podcast today with Stephen Datz. You know, most of the podcasts are more about the history of the person and trying to figure out that journey. And in this case, it was really more of an educational understanding of the process of how Stephen does his work and how that translates to a show, which is we're having a show that will be opening very shortly. And it's interesting because I know a lot of the things about Stephen, and as an art dealer, you get to understand your artist, how they tick and what works for them and doesn't work for them, just like you would a family member. And I know certain things about Stephen, but after hearing his process, it really, you know, hones in to who he is and how he has to do things to make it work. And also allows me to understand what I have to be aware of when he's going to do a show and the things that he has to deal with himself from a creative point of view, because he's a perfectionist and, you know, this makes him slower than normal artists in the sense that his production can't be that big. He just has to have it so before it ever leaves his studio. And, you know, if you look at the show, you can see why. I mean, it's just a beautiful show. But it also relates to his color sense and how he sees the world through his eyes. And he has unique eyes because he's a synesthetic. And that allows him to see colors and music and things just a tad different than the normal, you know, humans that run around Earth. Because it's a rare thing to have that where color can be a number and a shape and that type of component to the way he visualizes his color sense. So it's really interesting. I think anybody who is wants to get inside the brain of how an artist works, their method, their creativity, and what it requires for them to produce art and make art and create art, they'll enjoy hearing this one. This is Stephen Datz. Stephen Datz, got you on here again. Art Dealer Diaries, love that.
Again, Mark?
I know.
Don't you have other guests?
doesn't seem like I do, I guess. Actually, I just booked one today. I try to book them all the time. But, you know, you have this project you've been working on for 2 years, right? This is 2 years.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's been 2 years since the last show. Yeah,
that's right. Because the last time after you finish the show, I go, do we want to do another one next year? And you're eyes glassed over, and he said, and I said, how about 2 years? And he goes, oh, yeah, that seems to work better.
Yes, yeah. Well, there was other stuff that needed to be attended to. I had life stuff going on.
Life stuff will do it.
Yeah, it takes you out of the studio more often than you might like to admit. But, you know, at the same time,
people don't realize that, too. As an artist, you know, you still have to live. Things happen. Trauma happens. Things go on in one's life.
Yeah.
And as an independent contractor, you know, entrepreneur, which is what an artist is, you don't paint, you don't make money.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. And even more than that, it requires a certain degree of freedom from outside distractions. Right. So, I mean, as you've said, I'm a slow painter and I've been getting slower over the years.
Why do you think that is?
I've been more persnickety.
Persnickety with your own.
Yeah.
Want is to be the best.
Yeah. I've always tried to have a standard for myself that I never wanted to put anything out there. I always sort of looked at it like this. If somebody who's never heard of me gets a chance to see a painting, a single painting, I would like to do my best to ensure that that painting is the best thing I can possibly put out there so that people who are introduced to my work through friends who might own one or a gallery that they just happen to stumble into are left with an impression of like, oh yeah, that was good. That was a nice painting. I never wanted to put anything out there that I didn't feel like was my best effort.
It's an incredibly high standard to put on yourself, though.
Well, you yes, know? Yes, and yes.
I want a home run every time I'm at bat. That's all I'm wanting.
Well, the hedge for me is that, you know, the only paintings that make it out of the studio are the ones that I feel meet that standard. Mm. Or, you know, they're, listen, I try, as I've gotten older, I've tried to kind of internalize this notion that you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Mm-hmm.
This was something.
There is no perfect anyway.
No. And that was something like, there is a fellow by the name of Jim Reynolds, who great painter, wonderful human being. And he used to say, like, I don't feel like I've ever really so much finished a painting as abandoned it. You know, it had to go in a box and go to a gallery, or go in a frame and go to a show. And he, you know, even after he died, the Claggett Ray up in Vail published a book of his landscapes.
Right.
And it's Jim unedited, like, even like the incorrectly spelled names, like they took what he wrote down and they just printed it. And so many of those paintings, you know, he'll self-critique them in these little blurbs. He's like, yeah, if I could get this one back, I'd probably tweak that foreground a little bit. And I'm like, this is a man after my own heart, because I do that too. Mm. I see things and I just think, oh, I should have done that better. You know, I should have done it differently. But in the moment, in the process, you can't always, like, I'm not prescient. I can't see how the final painting is going to turn out.
Right.
I kind of have an idea of what I want it to be, but they are, in a way, they're sort of semi-sentient. Like, they tell you what they want. Mm. And sometimes you have to let go of the reference photo or the field study or whatever in the service of a better idea. So I'm always trying to navigate, like, okay, what's the best way to solve this problem? What's the best color to use here? But yeah, I want the things that I put out into the world to be things that I can stand behind and say, yeah, I'm proud of this. Mm. Like, I feel like this is the best I could do. This is the best effort I could possibly put forth, and it's successful. So that's, in a way, kind of where this show came from. All of those things that get left behind.
Mm-hmm.
The ideas that are in the moment of inspiration, just as good as any other. Like, you know, at the moment you see something in the landscape, that's inspiration.
Right.
It's binary. You know, it's either there or it isn't.
Mm-hmm. Does it have to be there, I guess?
Yeah.
I would think.
You got to be emotionally
invested. That way for my books, I have to have an inspirational kind of a something to have a nugget to build on.
Yeah, there's got to be a good seed of an idea.
Yeah.
In that, like, if I'm driving along and I see something, and this happens to me all the time, I can't turn it off, really. So I'm always seeing things and going, oh man, that contrast on that is just amazing.
Right.
Or, you know, the particular color harmony, or the way the light is moving, or the way the fog is moving, or any number of things.
And do you stop when you see those moments?
Yeah. Yeah. This is why I have, I fill up hard drives.
Yeah.
So fast, because I upgraded my camera a few years ago. So it takes really high quality images. But the problem is, everywhere I go, I'm stopping, taking photos. If I can't paint it or sketch it, it's like, oh, I'll just take a photo. And, so I have like 2 terabytes worth of just photo reference that I keep adding to. And I do that. I get up in the morning and look out the window. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
grab the photo, different. You know?
Yeah, no, I find, because I like to do photography too, that, I've gone back maybe 10 miles before. I see something. I know it's great. I keep going. I'm trying to get someplace, and then finally I go, oh, I got to turn around. I got to just take that photo of that.
Yep.
I'm sure you've done that on more than one occasion.
I've given myself permission to just take whatever photos I want.
Yeah.
Because sort them.
Yeah.
Get home.
So on your trip down from Colorado here, are you taking photos? You're looking and...
Yeah, always. I always have the camera with me because I'm driving through, the desert Southwest. I'm driving through a lot of the areas that I paint all the time.
And,
I did the part of the drive yesterday. And so I ended up on the southern part of the Navajo Reservation right at sunset. Never seen it in that light before.
Mm. What part do you remember?
Between Chinle and Ganado and I-40.
That's beautiful.
That little corridor down there. And especially once you get past Chinle, you get to, I think it's Burnside Junction.
Yeah.
And if you just keep going south, you kind of get some elevated viewpoints where you can sort of see the desert and the pinyons and sagebrush and stuff. Mm-hmm. But in that light, it was just phenomenal. I mean, it was like there was clouds until that much before the horizon. And then there was just sheet of orange light that lit everything up.
Isn't that amazing?
It was just lighting up sagebrush and pinions, but it was the way the hills and see shapes and arrangements and things. And
last night on the Catalinas, there was just this line, a single line of orange where it crossed through the, I didn't get a photo. I was cooking. And I was like, because I knew I would never get there. By the time I ran out to get the shot, it's going to be gone. Yeah. And the potatoes are going to be overboiling. But, you just have to go, okay, I'm just going to enjoy this.
Yeah.
It's there. I'm just not going to try to capture what I can't capture anymore. Yeah. But one single little line of orange, dark orange, where the light, because we were very, it was all cloudy
here yesterday. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Those are those moments that, you just see them and you go, this is amazing. But sometimes you don't. You don't get it right. You don't get the photo, or you can only get a photo. You don't even have time to make a pencil sketch of it.
Right. Is that ideal that you would make a pencil sketch?
Yeah, because the pencil sketch, like if I've got 3 or 4 minutes where I can actually just look at something, I can make enough information in that sketch where I'm already starting to make decisions. That's why thumbnail sketching is so important. I don't know if I've ever really heard anybody describe it in succinct terms, but a thumbnail is you're making the very first decision about that subject. You've seen something that you think, I like that. Now you're thinking, what's the shape going to be? Is it going to be a square? Is it going to be a rectangle? Is it going to be a panorama? Is it going to be tall?
And you're making that decision.
That's the very first decision. Yeah, the shape of your canvas is the first decision.
That's what Dixon did. Yeah, same thing, actually.
Because you want – I mean, I always try to choose the canvas shape based on what I think the subject needs. Mm. Some of them need to be panoramas. Some of them need to be tall. Some of them need to be square.
Yeah, and I think you do more square and panorama than most artists.
I love them.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. But it is interesting that you choose that.
Yeah. Because
if I think of all my landscape artists, squares are not generally, Jill Carver will do them, but not generally just the subject or the format that they choose. Why is that?
Well, I don't know. Speaking for myself, I didn't do square paintings for a long time because one of the enemies of a good composition is symmetry.
Yeah.
Right. So a square,
that's a great statement.
You're basically handicapping yourself right up front with a symmetrical canvas.
Yes.
Now you have to subdivide it in a way that's dynamic. Mm-hmm. And that can be kind of a daunting challenge because you have to make decisions. There's almost never a square painting where you don't cut off the sky. It's either a high horizon or a low horizon. Mm-hmm. It's either, you're very careful where you put your planes if it's a sort of a static composition or where your angles are going. You kind of stay away from that center. Like there's in any square canvas, if you've got a 9x9 just for easy, there's a 3-inch square in the middle where you really can't put anything important because it'll just become a bullseye. So you're sort of working around these edges.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
And the fun part of it is how far can I push? How much can I flirt with that dead zone in the middle. Mm. I saw a brilliant painting years and years ago that was basically just exactly that. It was an Indian on horseback with a full moon behind him.
Mm-hmm.
Dead center of a square canvas.
But they wanted your eye to go there.
Yes, but the problem is it would be very easy to get stuck there and not move anywhere else in the canvas. And he had this little thin cloud at a very shallow angle across the top of that moon. Mm-hmm. And then there was a couple of other little very subtle, but little bits of dynamic angular foreground. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, it was kind of like you could go up and get into that center in any number of ways, however your eye naturally chose to go there. Mm. But then you could get out of it again. and travel around the painting some more. And given the fact that the center of the painting was basically a circle, that was even more challenging. It's like, let's take the most static thing, you know,
that looks like a bullseye.
That looks like a bullseye and make it the shape of a bullseye and put something in the middle of it that is the highest contrast in the painting and the most color in the painting and see if we can get everybody to keep wandering around and looking at other stuff. And so it's like, okay, well, yeah, that you need to do that because that will help you grow a little bit more. And then the more, like, it's like once you unlock it, once you figure it out, then it's hard not to see everything as a square. Then every time I look at stuff, I'm like, oh, there's a square painting in there. There's a, you know, there's a rectangle in there.
Yeah, because you figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
Do you use dynamic symmetry in the process when you're laying it out?
It's in my mind.
Yeah.
I try to be as intuitive as possible with the compositions. I mean, I know all of the compositional like frameworks, the basic ideas, and you know, Edgar Payne lays these out, John Carlson lays them out. Everybody that's ever painted landscape has their ideas about composition and the right way to do it. So it's there, but I try to let my first pass just be intuitive. What feels right? Yeah. What feels best to me for this? Because I think if you get too much of your head involved up front, you really are starting to paint the painting you think you should paint instead of the painting you feel like you should paint.
Yeah, I think you get to a point where you just do it intuitively anyway. I mean, when I look in at a thing to take a photo, it's the thirds are there and I'm not thinking about thirds. I'm looking just, and I'm looking at dynamic symmetry, but I'm not thinking about dynamic symmetry.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, this feels right. You know?
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think as an artist, you know, there's a lot of questions about, well, how do you know what to paint? How do you settle on, like, what's your vision? What's your favorite theme or your favorite subject? And it's sort of like, well, I don't know. I try not to second guess it. I try to just let that moment happen and respond to it. And just, you never know when it's going to happen. You can set up circumstances. I mean, you can go to Grand Canyon or you can go wherever and put yourself in an environment where it's likely to happen often. But still, the best thing to do, I find, and I drove my fellow plein air painters crazy with this. You know, they'd all jump out of the car and be like, let's go. We got a great view here. And there'd be four different versions of the same basic view. And I'd wander off.
Right.
It would take me 45 minutes just to decide what to paint. And then I'm only, you know, halfway through the block in and everybody's like, come on, we got to go. You know, they're all done. And I'm like, wait, I haven't even started yet. So, but I feel like you have to be... You have to let it be organic.
Do you write notes like on the environment and things you're feeling or smelling or sensing at the time of you're doing it? Like,
yeah.
Jill does that. Jill Carver.
If I'm making, you know, if I have the time to make a sketch.
Yes.
So I'm thinking in terms of like, okay, visualizing myself painting this, what would I be mixing to make this color? What would I be mixing to make that color? Is it warm or cool? And, yeah, sometimes like a few years ago, I went out to Mendocino. Never been there before. It was, you know, my wife and I were desperate to escape August in Grand Junction. You know, it was a hot summer and there was fires all over the place. It was smoky. And we were thinking like, where could we go that would be the exact precise opposite of this? Turns out in August, Mendocino, California. It's foggy all the time. Never gets above 65 degrees.
Right.
And we went out there and it's quite a trip to get there. Like you basically have to fly to like San Francisco or one of those northern airports and then get on a back road and drive.
Right.
And but yeah, everything has a smell out there that's new. You know, the desert is so dry a lot of times you don't get much like olfactory.
It's a different kind of, unless you get rain and then you get kind of great smell.
Or like, you know, rain on sagebrush.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Or Ocotillo or creosote's the best. I mean, creosote, wet creosote.
Yeah.
It's just like, right, that's like cookies.
Yeah.
To me, actually. Isn't that desert rat?
Yeah. So that, you know, those notes got
put
a
in.
Bit more like, you know, you can really smell the sea air. Like you can really feel the moisture. There were points where you could stand on the edge of the bluff and you could, and again, being in a dry climate, you don't feel this kind of thing very often, especially not in like mild temperatures. You feel it when it's cold in the wintertime, but there was this onshore wind and it was coming up over the side of this bluff. And the fog was so fine, like it was this fine mist. Mm-hmm. And you could feel it on like every part of exposed skin. You're just feeling this gentle sort of like mm-hmm. cool. I had never really experienced anything like that before. Mm. Most of my travel in California has been in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like the climate's usually perfect down there. This whole foggy sort of moody atmosphere and all these new sensations in Mendocino. I still think, yeah, I'd love to go back out there again and actually stay for a longer time and do some painting.
And so when you did the notes, do you think it helped your painting when you referred back to those notes that you did?
I think, yeah. I think generally anything in the notes is designed to sort of put you back in the moment.
Yes.
Like that's the whole reason for writing that stuff down, is to like close your eyes, imagine what did it feel like to stand there?
Yeah, it brings you right back.
Yeah. And hopefully by doing so, some of that gets into your artwork.
Yeah, it has to.
Some sense of it, or it might affect your color harmonies. You know, if I'm painting that day, it's cool, foggy day, the color harmony is probably going to be fairly cool. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that can help reinforce the image.
Those would be hard paintings for you. Because when I think of your artwork, there's certain colors, you know, blue and orange, that definitely. I was looking at the palette that you had for, you sent some pictures of your palette. Mm-hmm. And I've been in your mm-hmm. studio, of course, but, you know, it's dozens of blues, dozens of oranges yeah. everywhere. I was going to ask you, when you do that palette, because this is, you know, there's a large range of colors on it. Do you wipe that out? How often do you clean your palette board?
It sort of depends on how big the painting is. Uh-huh. Like for large paintings, you have to sort of scrape it off. And I try to mix a lot of paint.
Yeah,
it is devilishly hard to recreate identically a color that you're mixing without measuring,
yeah.
you know? So I start with big piles of paint and I sort of feel like I will scrape it down when I run out of room.
Run out of room on
when the palette fills up.
I got it. Okay.
And then I need more space to mix and it's like, okay, well, what am I working on today? I'm working on shadows. So all the highlight colors are generally pushed off to the side, or I built some racks. I can take, you know, these pieces of plexiglass. I put like plastic or wax paper on them, put the paint dabs on there, stick them in the rack.
So you and can then I can, them again.
Yep. So yeah. I can bring them out and they're ready to go. And yeah, so it's sort of like, well, when I run out of room or when I'm having dueling things where it's like, I got too many, because sometimes you mix, like it's like mix and poke, you know, mix it, put it on there, see what you think. Mm. Mix it, because it looks different on the palette than it does mm-hmm. once it gets on the painting. The more paint you get on there, the more it changes the next stroke. You know, if you've got an area that's bright orange and you put a fairly gray stroke of paint on, it's mm-hmm. going to look more blue.
Mm, yeah.
Because of the optical contrast that our eyes and our brains create. So a lot of times I end up with five or six things that were almost right, but not quite, that are probably never going to get used. Mm. I mean, I typically don't throw them away. But once I hit on that right note, that's the thing I'm working with. Mm. And so when I get sometimes too many of those dead ends piled up on the side of the palette, it's time to scrape it off and make room.
And those dead ends, you actually poke it on there, see how it looks. If you don't like it, you take it off?
Yeah, well, I think in the photos I sent you, there was like a few big initial mixtures, like a big pile of orange paint, big pile of green paint, big pile of the purple or blue. And so, yeah, I pull out of those mixtures to create, I don't know how to describe it. I guess if you were to think of it in musical terms, it's like that's a key or you know, a chord or something. And then I'm pulling out variations to make, mm-hmm. you know, so this is going to be a little more green. This might be a little more warm. And so, yeah, it's like, try it, pull out the right thing, you know, pull out a bit of that, mix it down, put it on the painting and see what you think.
How long does that take to set up and do all the painting, set up just the color before you even begin?
Well, so like in the painting that I sent you the photos of.
Yeah, the big painting. Which that, we'll talk about.
To get those first three or four basic puddles of color, mm-hmm. that was a day. Mm. It was one day.
Just mixing and interesting.
And again, partly because these are the establishing notes, right? So the canvas has a framework drawn on it for the structure of the painting.
Right.
These are the framework for the color harmony. And so it's like you mix it out.
You draw on your painting, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And you lay out the imagery.
Lay it out.
What you're going to want.
Yep.
And then you start to put in the notes.
Yeah. And with those, you have to establish pretty quickly the right color relationship, right? So it's like, you know, and again, to use the musical analogy, guys, if you have a musical piece in a certain key, whatever notes and chords and melodies and harmonies you're building are built around that key. And so the color harmony on that palette at the very start is the key that's going to guide all the downstream decisions mm-hmm. about what to put in the painting and usually provide the basic starting point for the mixtures. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just a touch, you know, even if I mix something all new and maybe I take a palette knife load of that basic color and stick it in there. So these, you know, you mix them, you put a few bits here and there on the painting to establish, okay, do they look right together? Is this the right harmony?
A roadmap almost.
Yeah. And with the blue and orange, you know, for this, the painting and the photos that I sent you, it's that contrast is pretty vivid. You know, it's very easy to have something that's just too blue or has mm-hmm. too much green in it. Mm-hmm. It changes the way the two colors relate if you don't spend some time up front getting them right.
Mix it.
You know, mix it right. Mix the right amount of blue that has – it's kind of got to be the right gray. You know, there's a little bit less. It's not just pure blue. It's actually kind of gray. Mm-hmm. But next to the orange, it pops. So that first day of mixing and just putting bits on to see how it all relates to each other is kind of establishing the framework of the color harmony. And now once that's done, you know, okay, now I can go.
This sounds very much like cooking on a way. You know, you takes a long time to be a good cook. Mm-hmm. There's so many different things that go into it, but a lot of it's mixing and different types of spices and all that. So where mm-hmm. do you learn to do that? To do the color things. That's the basic beginning of how you have to learn to paint. It's so critical, but you know, it's also not intuitive, I wouldn't think. I think you actually have to watch or see or do the thing to find out how to do it.
Well, I think it depends on how your brain is set up to learn things. My brain's very visual, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
And I think I've mentioned this in previous things that we've talked about, this book that my dad had I was a kid, you know, I was a tiny little kid, 4 or 5 years old, and it was called The Elements of Color. Mm. And it was a treatise on optical color, how we see color, how color behaves when it's adjacent, you know, what the nature of color is. And I was always fascinated by that book as a kid because it had these big, bright, colorful squares, and it was just, you know, it was like, I don't know what I'm looking at. It was just really cool.
Well, you also see color differently than most people.
But I think that book is part of the reason why. Because I tend to be more interested in color than gray. You know, I love a good tonalist painting. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, George Ennis and some of the, you know, tonalist stuff that the California Impressionists were doing. It is amazing to me because it's almost like out of reach for me. You know, it would be like a championship, you know, baseball player watching golf raptly and just going, it's the same thing, hitting a ball with a stick. Why can't I do that? You know, why is it baseball and not golf?
Right.
I'm the same way. It's like, why is it, you know, this bright color and not the tonalist approach? And I think it just has to do with personality, but then you have to take responsibility for educating yourself about how color works. And that involves a lot of practice. Mm-hmm. And it involves a little bit of self-discipline in terms of making careful choices about what you put on your palette. For the kind of painting that I do, landscapes, southwest, mountains, you know, bright sunshine, bright colors. I have chosen a palette that I feel suits my approach to that subject matter. Mm-hmm. It gives me the broadest possible flexibility within a limit. And the limit is important because if you just run to the art store every time you run up against a color that you don't know how to make, you're going to have 60 or 70 bobs of paint on your, there's no room for that stuff. Like, you know, that's just too much. And the best piece of advice that I got from a fellow professional when I was first starting out was use a limited palette.
And I've heard that before from other artists.
Yep.
And what is limited, though? It's different for everyone because you clearly have a lot of different colors, even though they're in the same kind of range.
Oh, well, actually, I mean, I don't know if you can see it on any of the photos I sent you, but there's the broad range just within the 10 or so colors that I use.
Right.
But his advice was the best way to understand color is to start to hit the limits of what you can make with a limited palette. Mm. So when I first started out, it was four colors and white. Mm-hmm. Cad yellow, cad orange, alizarin crimson, ultramarine blue deep, and white. Mm. And that was 3 years. I would go out painting every day with just those colors.
Trying to understand them and what your limits were, what you could do with
and
those colors.
And to learn the range. Like this is the other thing that I did early on was I made lots and lots of color charts. Like I just mixed color. I would do tints and shades. I would do, you know, two colors mixed together, two neutral.
Do you keep these as a guiding force?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have a stack
of them. Like a recipe.
Yeah. Because it shows you what, like how far you can go with a color before you reach dead, you know, mud or neutral. Mm-hmm. It gives you a real sense of how do these colors mix? Because some pigments are very, very strong. You don't need a lot of them to really dramatically change a mixture. And some pigments are extremely weak. Mm. So you've got to just ladle it in just to move the thing, you know, a little bit. So you're learning about the pigment strength. You're learning about the range of mixtures that you can make. I went even so far as to take, I would do like a, you know, cad yellow and say like Viridian. Okay, that's my base mixture. I would do a whole chart of just those. Mm-hmm. Then I would take a 50-50 like or 90-10 or whatever. Like I would break down the mixtures of just those two and do a whole chart with just that. So like 90-10 yellow to Viridian with everything else on the palette.
Do you use those charts that you made still?
Not now. I don't.
You just have
it was.
This is a young man's learning process.
It was part of the learning curve.
And that you did that for 3 years? Well, you were using four colors.
I was using four colors for three years. And whenever I felt like I needed to understand a color better, or like if I felt like I'm kind of falling into habits with these things, like I'm using the same things to make green. I'm using the same things. And that's the beauty of it. That's the intention of it because that's what this guy said. He said, listen, when you get to the point where you're using the same things all the time, you know, it's a green tree, it's always this, you've lost it. That's the point when you know you need more color. You need another option on your palette. When you reach a point where you see a color in nature that you cannot make with that palette, no matter how many different variations you mix. Mm-hmm. You need to add another color to your palette. Do that judiciously.
Learn
before you take that thing out in the field. You know, this is very methodical advice that he was giving me. Like, be a scientist about it. Mm-hmm. Go buy a small tube of that thing. Do color charts with all your other colors that you're currently using and that you currently understand.
Right.
Because you really want to know, not is it a nice color out of the tube, what you really want to know is how's this going to work with what I've already got. Just the same as if you were cooking, you'd want to know, like, how's this new spice that I'm enamored of going to work with my, you know, my French country sort of approach or my, New Mexican approach. So I would do that.
And how many colors do you use currently?
Let's see, 10 or 11.
Yeah.
At best guess.
With 11 colors, that there's a massive amount of variation that you can make yes. with those. I mean, just massive.
Yeah. Yeah. You have, I mean, that's the thing is you don't need really a lot of colors, and you don't, I stay away from things that I can mix. This is another thing that I started doing when I started thinking about adding a color to my palette. Okay, I'm in the field. It's the light's changing. The bugs are buzzing around. I'm getting bitten by mosquitoes or snowed on or whatever. And I'm not analyzing what I'm doing with the colors. I'm just trying to respond to what I see. When you get to the point where you're adding colors, the next best step to take is, can I make this, go buy a tube of this stuff. Can I make this from what I already have on my palette?
Oh, yeah.
Because if I can, I should.
Yeah.
And the reason I should, and I've had debates with other painters that I've been out with about this, who are like, just get the, get the tube of whatever sap green out there or boreal green or whatever it might be. It saves time. Yeah, but that's somebody else's mixture. Somebody somewhere else decided what sap green was going to look like or boreal green or whatever. And it would be like, programming your keyboard with, a little harmony or a chord progression or something where all you have to do is press a button. It's like, it's always that, but it's always that.
Yeah.
And it's not that there's no value.
You want a little variation.
I want control.
And you see the way colors are different too, because you see a number associated with these colors to some extent, right?
Well, yeah. So I don't quite know how to explain it, but years ago, this was somebody that I was having color debates with, sent me a test, an online, this was an actual visual acuity, visual sensitivity. And it was 200, it was a grid.
Yes.
200 squares, kind of like your backdrop there actually. Right. And the challenge was arrange these in order from most green, to most red. And there wasn't really any pure color. Yeah. It was all shades of these two. And he's like, nobody I've ever given this to has ever been able to achieve more than an 80% on this thing. So I was like, all right, well, I'll try it. It's a computer. So monitors, colors are different on monitors, on cameras, everything. Digital interpolation changes colors. But I sat down with it and I spent about 45 minutes, got it all arranged, I'm squinting at the screen, doing this. And my wife's like, are you done with that thing yet? I'm almost there. So I finally sort of felt like I think I've got it. Hit the button. Congratulations. 100% correct.
Yeah.
I was able to arrange 200 shades of gray, basically, in the correct order of color to color and, gray. In all these weird subtle grays, and it blew me away. I was like, "What? How? Really?"
So that's synesthesia.
How the heck?
That's what it is.
Because I didn't expect to do very well on it. And
but you see color differently. That's why
I see color differently. But also,
you see it actually analog. I mean, that shows that it's very much analog. This is 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5. Yep. Oh, now we're at 2.
Yeah, and so that. Without really my knowing it, until I started thinking about this stuff and learning about, synesthesia and what this is, it was affecting the way that I mixed color. Mm. And that's the thing. People often are surprised when I tell them probably half of my time painting is actually mixing color and
I'm surprised.
Testing it.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised.
Mix it, test it. Yeah. Mix it,
but now
test
I understand
it.
Why.
Tweak it, test it again, scrape it off.
It also is, I want the control and perfectionism.
Yes. Well, see, so that's the thing. I mean, I'm a perfectionist at heart, and that works against me a lot of the time. It frustrates me to no end.
Sure.
But having discrete, I think of them as primary colors simply because when you talk about red, green, and blue, or red, yellow, and blue, those are colors that you can't make from other things. Mm-hmm. They're sort of just they just are. And that's kind of what I aspire to have as palette choices. These colors just are. You can't make them from what you already have. So then you have control. then you can indulge the perfectionist, because I can make, you know, a mixture and I can be like, nope, just needs a little bit more of that blue. Nope, just a little bit more, just a little bit more, just a little bit more. And I can just gently push it to where I want it. Mm-hmm. And then once it's right, like there's a moment of like, yeah, I think that's it. And more often than not, put it up on the canvas. Yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So there's a lot of trial and error of mixed color, mixed color, mixed color. Try it. Okay. Maybe. Let me see if I can tweak it with a little more of this or a little more of that. It needs to be cooler. It needs to be warmer. Like I'm very intuitive about the process of mixing, but I'm also scientific about it. I'm testing constantly.
It also allows that no one can duplicate your paintings, quite frankly.
Well, I, you know,
they can't.
I haven't thought about that, but
they can't because the colors are so uniquely yours. Same with Howard Post. People can't do Howard's things because he just has such a unique color palette. And when you have that, I think that's a takeaway for artists that are listening to this. You know, if you can make your colors where no one can, you know, reproduce them, because only you can do it through trial, error, time, commitment, then it, you know, it allows you something unique.
And it also, in a weird way, it protects you against duplication, because one of my prime frustrations in photographing my work to try to get images for galleries and whatnot is it never – I can't make it look right. I can use every tool in Photoshop. I can do every tweak and trick. And in order to test this, I actually had a professional photographer who is experienced photographing artwork. I said, listen, I want you to shoot some paintings for me. And he did. And we sat down at the computer together. He said, now, some of these, like, I just can't, they don't look right. They, right out of the camera, they just don't. The greens are killed, or the orange is too bright, or this is that. You lose some gray. And he would sit down at the computer and isolate little areas where he thought that the color had gone bad. And this is just proof of that optical phenomenon that I was talking about, the simultaneous contrast, I think it's called. Our brains, it's, you know, blue and orange, that vibrancy, that kind of like that electric, exciting vibrancy, that happens in our eyes and our brains. It's not a native property of the pigment. So when he shot those photos with his camera, the photo, it, you know, it's a digital interpolation.
Right.
The camera can't do what our brains and our eyes can do. Yeah. So learning how to make those colors and learning how to make them work really well together and learning to pull the most power that you can out of them, that can't be duplicated because it's not happening in a camera or a scanner or any photographic process. It's an inherent property of our biology. So that kind of helps protect you also against the, you know, those out there who might decide they want to take a stab at forging a painting. You know,
right. Well, like they can't just get CAD green off the, you know, out of the store because you don't use it.
I don't use it. And you can't learn how to maximize the potential of any given palette if you don't put in the time researching it, making the color charts, learning how the colors work together.
Yeah. The only possible way to do it would be through AI that can literally take all your understanding of color sense and then mix it and do it.
Even that, though, is going to be relying on, I mean, an AI can't walk into my studio yet. And even if it could, it's not a biological organism yet. So it doesn't have rods and cones and optic nerves and, you know, frontal lobes occipital lobes.
That is very true.
It will still be essentially a camera. It might be a camera with very sophisticated algorithms and lots of relevant database capabilities, but it's still
a camera. That is true. Rods and cones are uniquely human. And that may be a harder thing for them to, especially for somebody like you who is so uniquely driven by color.
Yeah. Well, and
that's a good title for you, Driven by Color. No, that really would be an excellent show.
Driven Insane by Color.
Yeah, Driven by Color. Well, I figured out the insanity fairly quickly when you start representing somebody. Like, okay, I understand. I won't be getting a lot of work because you can't do it. And
mean, well, I used to do more, but the thing about, because I look back at my early field studies and things, and I just go, God, this was like an hour and a half. Why can't I do that anymore? But if you look at some of the paintings that have come in for the show.
Yeah, I did.
You're going to see in that little 8x10
everything.
More nuance and yeah. more subtlety and more color and yeah. better, deeper, richer color harmony.
Yeah, I can already tell.
Than you would see in those early field yeah. studies.
I can look at this work. I just looked at it for, 20 minutes, whatever. And I could go, they're all, you nailed them all the little ones. There's just like every one of them is a little gem.
And that's part of the reason, that you don't get as much is like, yeah. unless I feel like I can get that. Like, I want to bring my painting body of work in here to you because you're going to, you're having a show, you're taking some time, you're spending some money, and, it takes effort to put on a show. Yeah. Galleries have to put in a lot of work to hang it, market it, get people in, right. sell the paintings, ship the paintings. Like, it's a lot. So I don't ever want to walk in here with a body of work. And this is the same for every gallery I've ever been in. I never want to walk through the door and have the guy who owns the gallery go, that's not up to your usual standard,
Most gallerists, I hate to tell you, couldn't tell you that if there is or isn't, honestly. They would just go, cool, a lot of work, 16 by 20s, excellent.
Yeah.
There is some of that.
I had a gallery like that. Yeah. She just wanted quantity all the time. Quantity, yeah. quantity, quantity. Shows were like 40, 50 paintings. I'm killing myself.
But you can't do that.
That was back in the day when I could.
And we have, what do we have? How many paintings are in the show?
18.
Yeah, that's two years basically. I mean, you've given us some periodically.
Yeah, there's been like 10 or 12 that have come over 2023. Yeah. Because I didn't want to leave you high and dry.
Right, and we've sold those. So. They've consistently sell.
Yeah.
And we're pretty much your main gallery probably at this point.
At this point.
Not the gallery. So, which is nice. Which makes sense. You'll see this with certain artists that do take so much time, to produce. They can't have – it'd drive you insane to have more than two galleries, honestly.
Well, yeah. You can't keep the standard up. And that was one of the things that always bothered me about this other gallery was I just felt like if it was even a 70% out of 100, I had to slap it in a frame and get it out there. There are paintings that she sold that I just was like – I wish I could have this back, but people who come to my studio, this is where the idea for the show came from. The baker's racks where I have stacked all of the reject paintings, are endlessly fascinating to people who come visit the studio. They're like, well, this is amazing. I'm like, no, it's not. It's not. When look at this, that one's getting ready to go to Mark Sublette. Yeah. Tell me this is as amazing as that. Oh, well, no, I guess you're right. I'm like, yes, I'm right. Please step away from the racks.
These are rejects.
Don't tell me I could make $1 zillion selling all these rejects. They are process. They are the leftover dough after the donuts get made.
Yeah. The only way you could do it would be you'd have to redo all of them and revisit all of them. And it'd be almost just takes you just as much time to do that as just a new painting.
Yeah, well, that's the show. I mean, I went back through. It was kind of – the idea kind of stuck with me after I did the book.
Yeah.
Because that was going through stacks of old paintings. Right. And like, how many of these did I actually start in Jackson Hole and never like just
come home? Right. This was a show we had done earlier, I don't know, two years ago,
yeah.
The book. And
the book came out.
A bunch of smaller work from Jackson Hole.
Yeah, they were field studies that had been started on location but not ever finished on location.
We still have the book, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
If you want.
Yep.
It's a great book.
On sale now.
Yep.
And but I enjoyed that more than I thought I would.
Mm.
And it started making me think about a very simple truth of landscape photography or landscape painting, which is like, you can't be in more than one place at one time looking in one direction. So you're going to miss a lot of cool stuff and you're never going to be able to paint them all. That was something that was said to me early on.
Yeah.
Just don't sweat it. Just pick the thing you want and stick with it. Yeah. Don't try to switch in the middle and be like, ooh, it's better over here now. Like, don't do that. Just focus.
Right.
And I started thinking about it. And I thought, God, I haven't looked through these stacks for years in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
What good ideas could be lurking in here?
Lots,
and
I'm sure.
yeah, so what's here is those things where I was like, oh my God, I forgot about this one.
Yeah, and you probably have a memory and a sense to that time anyway, as soon as you see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that kind of, I don't remember when I described it. I had somebody over to the studio that was looking at the racks of old paintings and rejects and half finished field studies and whatnot. And she was like, this is amazing. Like, this is really like looking inside your brain almost. And I just sort of offhandedly said, well, you know, it's, I think of it as my muse's memory.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really what it is, mm-hmm. because those are the moments when, you know, if you want to think of it in terms of the muse is really, you know, talking to you, you're seeing this moment of inspiration. Yeah. Those ones, even though they weren't fully realized or they didn't quite work out
there,
there's
for you to
still,
be able to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah. There's this memory there
yes.
for me to go back to and revisit and get excited about over again. And, you know, I've, as a plein air painter, I was always out looking, you know, when I was really heavy plein air before I had a studio and it was mm-hmm. all plein air work.
Yeah, I remember.
It was just like every day go out and find a new road, find a new place to go, right. like go see new stuff there. We love new stuff. Humans just love new. You know, we mm-hmm. always love that novelty.
And puzzles, yeah.
And I loved it. You know, I there's places on my list of things to go visit that I still haven't gotten to 20 years after I put it on the list. It's like, I want to get there. But at the same time, when you're relentlessly looking for that new thing to paint, sometimes you forget that you've actually seen some pretty cool stuff mm-hmm. already.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't get done or it didn't work out. You stuck it in your studio. You forgot about it. And so that was kind of the impetus for this show is go back and revisit some of those old ideas that have been in there or in the to-do pile.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I have like, it's about 60 things, 60 sketches deep of just things I want to develop, you know, ideas that are right. waiting for me. And so I thought, what the heck? Why don't I just go back through these old ideas and find the ones that still like get me excited? Because sometimes you pull a painting out and you go, I don't know what I was thinking here. Mm-hmm. Like what?
But that's part of the education process by going yeah. through there. It also, it's almost like a course you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
You go, oh, I see how I've developed. This is what I'm doing, right? This is what yeah. I like now more. Oh, that was a good little subject, or there's something brilliant about that, but I didn't know how to do it
yeah.
at that point.
Yep. Or you can see, you know, you can see where you, you know, you look at a sketch, I look at something I did in the field maybe, you know, 25 years ago, and I see in that all the things I didn't know at the time.
Yeah, of course.
The compositional mistakes, I didn't know. I, you know, that was a learning moment for me to do that painting. And that's the value of those things, even though a lot of those things will never see the light of day.
Until we have a sale.
They're
yeah.
Studio's
gone. We've got all these great paintings.
Well, you know, I mean, I know that that happens. And I kind of watched that with a couple of estates where it was just like,
yeah.
everything must go.
But, you know, it's beyond your control to most part. I mean, you can give your wishes and let your wife or whomever know. But doesn't matter. You know, it is what it is
yeah.
at that point. Your great paintings will live on and, you know, the other ones will be whatever they will be.
Well, this will amuse you or probably horrify you actually. But every time I've moved studio, I have ruthlessly gone through and weeded out.
Them, yeah.
And what I did was I got the most god-awful, ugly, like terrible color I could find in an oil bar or like yeah. one of those waxy and anything that was a reject just got an X across it in that. And then it got pitched in the dumpster.
Yeah. So. I've had a few artists, Pete Nisbet did that one time. Yeah. There's a few that do that. I get it. You're a perfectionist too. So it makes it hard, but yes, as an archivist, as a historian, and as an art dealer, yes, that I don't like that because it shows the process. I mean,
yeah.
how will we feel about that if we go, you know, Picasso throughout and did all that? Well, here you go. That seems like a travesty. But
yeah.
even Dixon on his drawings, he had everything broken to thirds. So a third would be for sale. A third would be for further evaluation to do, you know, different
right.
big pieces from.
Yeah.
And a third was just tossed.
Yeah. Well, it will comfort you to know that I haven't done that recently. Yeah. The last studio move was in 2006, right after we bought our house and I got my studio set up.
Yeah.
And that was the last time. And I didn't toss very many because at that point I started to understand, oh, wait a minute. Even the most miserable failure of a painting has – sometimes there's a bit of foreground, a bit of background, a bit of color, a bit of something that you can use. And this is something else that I've started doing more of is it's like, well, you know, Jim Wilcox is very well known for doing this. He's great, you know, Grand Teton painter. Yes. You know, he's well known for those paintings. And I used to get totally flummoxed when I was first starting out because I'd go up there and be like, I don't see any of his foregrounds. Like, it's flat. It's utterly flat until you get to the mountains. And he'd have these dramatic, you know, aspen trees and things. And what? And then I talked to him and he's like, oh, I just make it up. You know, you make up what you need. You serve the idea. Mm-hmm. The composition should serve the idea. So if I need a grove of aspens and some big boulders over here, hey, it frames the painting, frames the main mountain there.
Sure.
You should just do what you want. That's what artistic license is for, is just do what you want.
That. You would get rid of certain images or simplify.
Yeah.
So the shadows work better.
Yeah. I mean,
all good artists do that, honestly.
You kind of reach a point where you feel like I'm doing the idea. Like, if I stick to the literal truth of this thing, this is not going to be as good of a painting.
Yeah. It won't be, too. So. Yeah. Sometimes you need to edit.
Yeah.
And you have to learn how to simplify. That takes time and energy and age. Yeah, right? I mean, it's not just
something. I wish I could do it. I mean, I feel sometimes what are you doing? Well, there's a – I forget now which musician said this. There was a jazz musician. I can't remember the name, but – somebody was asking him, like, when you do your improvisations, you know, it's just so – you're all over the map and there's notes up here and notes down there. Right. And I guess his response was, well, you know, why would you use one note when seven will do? And I'm like, this is my curse, you know, because I'm like that. That's the – there's an impressionistic aspect in my work.
Yes.
In that if you really look at it, like take a 3x3 inch section of any painting, you're going to see a lot of color in there. Like there is a lot of impressionistic juxtaposition of slight variations on blue or green or whatever. Right.
Plus a lot of brush strokes too.
Yes. A lot of brush strokes.
A lot of small little brush strokes.
I do. And that bothers me sometimes. I wish I could stop myself from doing that.
Because it just takes so much time.
Well, it takes time. And I don't know. I'm of two minds on it. I mean, I look at Dixon's and Post's and, you know, Ed Mills. And I think, God, well, I wish I could just let it be a shape.
Yeah.
I'm working on that. I mean, I'm trying to – I've been saying for a few years now, like I'm trying to do a few experiments in just like abstraction. More than anything, but I keep finding myself drifting back to that sort of like, well, fractile, why should I, you know, why should this just be one shade of sage green when I can have all these delicious little variations in there? And in an abstract painting, that can also make it better.
Yeah. I'm sure Seurat said the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I've got his problem, you know, it's like, it's just going to be dots at some point. But it does frustrate me because I see the simple block in and I go, man, I kind of just went too far with this one maybe. Mm. But then at the same time, I look at it and I think, yeah, but there's stuff in here that, and I've had people say this to me, which is part of why I'm so conflicted about it. I've had collectors of my work tell me, we see stuff in your paintings years after we buy them. Mm. We look at them every day.
Yeah.
And then one day, I didn't notice that little green dot before, or I didn't notice that, you know, this shape was in there and it's, you know, it's part of a larger shape, but there's definitely like an element there that is essential to the painting. So that's something too, as an artist, it's like, I would love to be able to create paintings that you know, you can rediscover over and over and over again, no matter how long you look at them.
Yeah, and I think your paintings do you know, do that. Because even I look at, you know, because they're right next to my bed and I look at them every day. And even I, who see these all the time, go, huh, that's interesting. It's kind of different than I, yeah, there's some shadowing or something in there that makes it feel uniquely new.
Yeah. So. It's like it should have enough visual impact to catch you right away.
Yeah.
And pull you in and say, hey, look at this. Isn't this light spectacular? But then years down the line, and this has certainly been true in my art, limited art collecting, is the paintings I feel like I've completely and thoroughly explored and discovered, and there's nothing new to see there, are the ones I end up selling. Mm. They're the ones I get tired of looking at. It's the ones that I can't quite figure out that keep me coming back and stay charming and fresh. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing, is they stay a little bit fresher. It's always a little bit more of a thrill to look at those.
Because they're harder.
Yeah. Just think, well, what am I going to find in here today? You know? Mm-hmm. So there's an aspect of that, which, I mean, these are all kind of gray areas. It's up to the individual artists. You know, simplicity has its own power.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Miles Davis didn't get famous playing simple compositions.
Well, that's for sure. So, well, there's a lot of things he got famous for.
Well, you know, from a musical perspective,
yeah.
His art is, you know, him and Charlie Parker and, yeah. you know, Dexter Gordon, Cannonball Adderley, all these guys, if you listen to their stuff, man, it's like you hear stuff in there that you didn't hear. Even the thousandth time you listen to it, you hear new things and you go, oh my God, I didn't notice that before. Mm-hmm. And that's always, there's always been that urge in my heart to have an element to that in a painting.
Do you think you could have gotten where you are now without being a plein air painter first?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the art would be completely different. And the key element of that, because I was interested in landscapes back in college.
Right.
But the value of plein air painting is learning how light works in the real world. Mm. It's watching the sun move, how the colors change through the seasons, through the day, through the hours of the day, understanding, you know, how light and shadow contrast works.
It's grounding you to nature.
Yeah. And it's giving you, I mean, since I was interested in nature anyway, it's like, well, this is the vernacular, you know, the vernacular of light is the thing you need to understand. Right. It's the language of the landscape. So, and then, you know, getting a better understanding of shapes and, you know, there are natural compositions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you run across these things, you see them and go, it doesn't really conform to any actual like compositional stem, but there's a beautiful pattern there, mm-hmm. you know, that I can turn into a painting or a beautiful, you know, just the nature of small contours in a landscape
mm-hmm.
and how those planes really, you know, the more vertical they are, the more they catch that direct sunlight. But you can do these beautiful things if you can really understand and see those planes. And the only way to get that knowledge is to actually go look at it in action.
Yeah. And muscle memory too.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're learning, like the thing about plein air is it hones your intuitive skills. You know, you have to become intuitive about color. When you're working in a 1.5 to 2 hour window
yeah.
against whatever, and you know, plein air painting, there's kind of a romantic, I think, idea about it. It's like, oh, you know, you go out and so you're out in nature and it's fresh air. And it's like, you know, it's rain, weather, bugs,
wind.
People, wind. I mean, it is, you know, it is not like an idyllic, you know, rare are the days when you go out and it's just like everything's perfect.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like playing golf.
Yeah.
You know, rarely is it not going to have some kind of, oh my gosh, you know, beehive going over you or wind or sun or whatever.
Yep.
You still enjoy it, but it may not be a fun environment.
Yes. You're enduring a small number of minor hardships to right. get it done. And the benefit of that is that you can very quickly hone your eye to spotting the thing that interests you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's so much out there. That's the thing is it's like there's 360 degrees.
Like, but you don't use figures or buildings in your pieces because they just don't interest you?
They don't interest me.
Or at least at this point.
There's never say never.
Yeah, I mean, look at Ed Mel, right?
Yeah.
He goes and starts doing flowers and does people and animals and stuff too.
Yeah.
But he's a landscape painter.
Yeah. For me, I guess I would probably describe it as partly a reflex against resorting to, I don't know, this probably sounds overly harsh, but resorting to a trope.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Western art is full of small figures, small buildings in this majestic landscape. I understand why. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yep.
It can help give a sense of scale. It can help create, a little more of a connection to a painting. My counter argument was always that the first thing I tend to see in a painting like that is the people. Unless they're really, really
subordinate. I think some of that is because of just who you are and what you are. You're looking at landscapes, and your mind goes, I would think, immediately go, be better without the people in it because I like the pure landscape.
Well, and I think it probably comes back to a degree to my outdoors, going backpacking and whatnot.
Yeah.
The best trips were the ones where we didn't see any other people.
Yeah.
And I could just be out there seeing the landscapes, seeing the shapes without,
it's like fly fishing. I don't want to see anybody else.
Yeah. I don't want to see another human being. And the soul of my work, I think in some ways is this is just me and this tableau of canyon country or mesas or whatever. And I would like to give the viewer that same experience of like, there's no people in here. There's no buildings. There's nothing except you and this raw, natural world. And how does that make you feel? Because I go out and do that. And when I get lucky enough to be in a place where it's absolutely staggeringly beautiful and there are no other humans around making noise or taking selfies or whatever, I like that feeling. I like that feeling. It's narcotic. And so I would like to make sure that if I can give something to somebody else through my paintings, it's that feeling of like solitude in a majestic world.
Yeah, I get it.
Not that you don't want to go out for pizza and beer after you experience the solitude, but in the moment.
I like it all. I mean, I love a Josh Elliott painting that has the human experience that's part of the landscape that really is. It's congruent with it.
Yeah.
It's not without those hogans or those old barns or whatever it is, those telephone poles or whatever it might be. It really isn't what we see today.
Yeah.
And that's what, at least for him, that's what he's capturing is that sense of the moment of the land and now, not 30 years ago or 100 years ago or anything else. But so I think there's room for all of it. I just find it, I do find it interesting that that hasn't piqued you. Like I could see Anasazi ruins, which are just little stones that are into the, you can't, in fact, you have to look hard to see them sometimes they're so, part of the the land.
Yeah.
But you'd probably see them and go, man, I need to scoot down a bit.
Well, it's
so they would be perfect for your little.
It's not a,
they would be perfect.
I think it's probably just a matter of personality. And at some point I'm kind of a hermit. I'm not a very social person really.
Most artists aren't.
I come down here and for a week or two a year and socialize. And then it's like, okay, everybody go away and leave me alone.
Yeah,
I don't want to talk to anybody. I want to answer the phone. Yeah. Like, just get out of my life. I need to go paint.
Yeah.
And that I don't always relate as well to, the human experience in the landscape, like with the Indians or the Anasazi or whatever. I see it, but I'm much more intrigued by
color,
the happenstance. Shape, light. Well, just the happenstance of natural structures.
Yeah.
The fact that this canyon eroded in such a way that at a certain time of day, you get this tremendous glow,
right.
You're getting one little bit of sunlight, but it's casting this light down into this sandstone and it's making everything amazing, right?
And I would see it, oh, we see this light like this that's coming in that's doing this over millennia, and that group of people put their house right there or their because they wanted to capture that essence of God or whatever that's that sensibility.
Yeah.
So, you know, I see it that way too.
Yeah. Well, and part of it also comes from, I mean, the area where I live and most areas of Colorado that aren't like designated national parks or wilderness, there are a lot of nice views, including out in my neck of the woods where there's houses that have been built right up into it.
Right.
And so there's also kind of a reflexive, just like, get that off my shit out of here, you know, get it out of here. Yeah. This is a nice view. I don't want to look at your god awful architecture.
Yeah.
You know, who designed this house anyway? Yeah. Now with a Hogan or a native, you know, structure, that's not necessarily going to apply, but there's sort of this similar reflex of like, I don't.
Yeah. Your 10,000 square foot house.
I just don't want that in there. I want my paintings to be about
your experience,
nature basically. And my experience of it.
Your experiential paintings.
And not to be anchored to a human element.
Yeah. I get it. It's who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're being true to your soul and what you need to see.
Yeah.
And the best artists do that, no matter how they're pushed. They go, yep, no, this is me. I'm not putting that in there. Or I'm doing, you know.
There's kind of almost a natural reflexive, no, I don't think so.
So what do you think with this show? So you get to see it in the gallery. It's not hung yet, obviously, but it's always a little different, right? When you bring in the body work, it's all been kind of just here and there in your gallery and your studio. A lot of them probably not even, you can't even see them. You got them turned over the other side. What's that feeling like when you get that?
Well, this gallery is so big sometimes, like no matter what I bring in, I'm like, I didn't bring enough.
Yeah.
Like what? Wait a minute. This isn't enough. I need to make more. Yeah. It's like, I can feel myself going, I got to go home and paint a couple more if I can.
You got time.
I got 4 days.
Yeah. You can get 1 2x2.
Yeah. So, but it's nice to see them sort of lit. And really the most fun element for me is just getting that off the cuff reaction from the people in the gallery, you know, the staff and anybody that happens to be in here, you know, who just is like, surprise.
Yeah.
And watch, you know, watch what they do and how they react and what they say. And, and it's fun to see it all together. It's always fun to see it all hung together.
Yes.
I always have a moment of relief of like, all right, well, I guess I did okay this time, you know, I should do better next time.
And I got 2 more years. I'll have another one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's up for discussion too. It just depends. But, you know, this show's a little different in the sense that there's a few more like Colorado, like mountain alpine type contributions to it. Because that is also, I mean, those subjects are as close to my heart as the desert is.
Yeah. We've sold as many of those, I think. They don't sell any differently for us than the other ones. Good art's good art.
Well, it's funny too, because I think as an artist trying to, you know, satisfy various galleries in various places, you know, the ideal would be to have like any painting could go anywhere and sell.
Yeah, should pretty much, really.
And that is not the case. And part of that comes down to the people who run the gallery.
Yeah,
you know, if their clientele comes in and says like, you know, I want Carbondale, Colorado, because we're in Carbondale, Colorado. Where's the Mount Soper's paintings?
It's like, right.
Well, okay, you know.
I mean, I look at our show that was done up in, you know, Jackson Hole show, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We sold all those,
yeah,
right? Which I knew we would.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
and
it's
I've the kind artwork. Of, you know, the years in the business have sort of, in a weird way, beaten into me this notion of like, well, all right, so that's a desert gallery. You got to send them desert paintings.
Yeah.
And I sometimes chafe against that. I'm like, I can't take any more red. Like I literally can't look at red anymore. My eyes hurt every time I look at it. I want to go up into the green summer mountains and paint snow fields and cloud shadows, you know?
Right.
And so I have to kind of unlearn that reflex of like, oh, mountain stuff goes to mountain galleries, desert stuff goes to desert galleries. Cause you guys really can sell anything.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's nice because I feel like, well, I have a little more freedom. Like I could definitely send them some variety of subject
matter. We sell every kind of subject landscape wise, whether it's ocean or mountains or whatever.
And that's perfect because I, you know, one of the things that I also set out to do as a landscape painter was to not get typecast.
Yeah.
I very deliberately did not duplicate subjects very often. I would never paint the same painting twice unless it was like a small study and then something that was more developed.
Right.
But they were always distinct. And try to paint everything. Like I would go to California and paint.
Right.
I would go back east and paint. You know, try to go painting in Connecticut or Chester County, Pennsylvania. It's a whole different world out there from anywhere else.
Trees and gray and green.
Gray and green. Yep.
Yeah.
But beautiful atmosphere.
You can give those to your Pennsylvania ones.
I don't have any galleries east of the Mississippi at this point. So.
No, it's interesting. We do have lots of East Coast clientele. Not only that, or just our clients, but also live here, right? Because, you know, there's nothing more. I have lots of Canadians that are from like Ontario and Montreal and different places like that.
And that's, you know, I think sometimes the gallery, you know, these folks, maybe they live in, you know, for work reasons or family reasons or whatever, or that's just where they are. They live in a place like, you know, Ontario or Connecticut or Delaware, and they come here. And so their art buying tastes are sort of reflective of that. We love the Southwest.
Yeah.
You know, we can't live there. There was another beep there.
I know.
But we love it and we want to have some of it on our walls. And the weird thing that think of it what you will, I don't tend to have a lot of people come into galleries anywhere that I've ever shown and go, where's your Connecticut paintings? Like, why don't you have any of those like moody, rainy, green days in you know, Connecticut in the summertime? It's just the charm of the Southwest and the unique nature of the Southwest.
Yes. Well, I think we've covered it all. We've got a beep from our camera. I'll look into this camera over here. But anything else you want to say? Or
I think we've covered it.
It's interesting. You know, this was a talk about our much more detailed into the minutiae, which is interesting. There's a lot of depth on you anyway to talk about different things, you know, from your lifestyle. But I like that. You know, it's always learning for me to be able to listen and go, oh, okay, I didn't understand that. And it helps me not only understand the paintings better, but actually able to sell better.
Yeah.
And go, oh, look, let me tell you about his color sensibility.
And that's the thing, talking about it.
Yeah.
When you're just doing it by yourself.
Right.
You don't always think about it, but having conversations with people about these things, you sort of have to, you know, it kind of clarifies it for you. It's like, oh, yeah, this is what I think. I just haven't put it into words really before, but this is definitely my viewpoint.
Yeah. Well, how about some Mexican food?
Okay.
I said, let's go do that.
Let's go do that.
Thanks, Stephen. That's our Dealer Diaries. Come see our show. It'll be up, you know, it's...
next week.
It'll be up. So this is for people who are watching this. This is the end of April and it'll be up April through, you know, almost all of May, actually. So assuming there's paintings. They have a problem about selling. They all go.
You know, people do tend to want their paintings, you know.
Right. It's like, it's mid-April. It's mid-June. Can I have my paintings?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, but this is a nice time because we like to leave them up a little longer if we can. All right. Thank you, Steve.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Mark. Bye.